From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You may not have noticed, but it's Speed Week out on the Bonneville Salt Flats. It means hundreds of people who are obsessed with motors and speed gather to race and catch up and check out each other's projects. Louise Noeth describes the week as a mechanical circus. Actually, they call her Land Speed Louise, and if you get her started, which we intend to do today, she'll talk your ear off about the salt flats and the scene unfolding out there. Louise describes it as the American dream. She'll be with us today. Also, we'll have with us members of the multi-level marketing and direct selling industry. We're giving them a chance to respond to the conversation we had on Tuesday and the charges that companies like Mary Kay Cosmetics and Nu Skin use unethical practices. So join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It bothers Louise Noeth that a lot of people who live in Salt Lake City, in places not that far from the Bonneville Salt Flats, don't go and see the flats or just drive by them on their way west. Louise, who goes by the name Landspeed Louise, is a journalist and an automotive historian. She's also an expert on the salt flats and the racing community out there. Louise wants to show people what they're missing. She's described the flats as the largest expanse of serene nothingness with which a person might ever bond. Landspeed Louise is going to be in Salt Lake City this weekend. She's giving a lecture at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. It's part of an ongoing exhibit there that features more than a dozen of the world's fastest and most beautiful race cars. Today in the program, she's joining us to talk about cars and speed and the flats. You can join us, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Landspeed Louise Noeth is the author of Bonneville Salt Flats, The Fastest Place on Earth. She writes a monthly column about land speed racing for the magazine Good Guys Gazette, and she's joining us today. And welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me.
So you're from Chicago.
Originally.
Read that your grandfather was a machinist. Guy who invented that key that they used to open cans of ham.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Right. What is it that where did you get your interest in cars? I mean, was that something that you got from the family? People sort of tinkering with things?
I think it's congenital, because as far as I have a memory, I've always been fascinated with mechanical things. I mean, I wasn't the kid that took the washing machine apart, but I was always fascinated on, you know, what made it work? Well, that's what that does, but how does it do it? So that question's always been present. Mm. And whether I took it apart or had somebody else take it apart, that was always a fascination. And I've always had some artistic bends here and there, and I think the two of them went together because I always thought they were quite pretty. To me, you know, the Eiffel Tower is a great, beautiful thing, but it's a great technical structure. It's like, how'd they make that big thing so big and not fall down, you know? Mm.
So it's what's interesting about that is that it seems like your first interest in cars wasn't necessarily in the motors part, but in the art part?
It was, yeah, because I used to compete, used to make models. They'd have the hobby shops, you know, in the local neighborhoods. And I'd be the only girl that would enter a car. And it would be okay if I entered, but when I won, it caused problems.
What do you mean?
Well, because I was a girl. The guys wanted to win the car. There were no girls that would build model cars. I was the only kid that did that.
You said that that mechanics fascinated you, sure, from a technical perspective, but also from an artistic perspective. Is that what you mean by the Eiffel Tower, that it's the combination of those things?
Indeed, yeah, and the same thing with the cars. I'm also 50% deaf, so for me, any kind of interesting sound was kind of like the snake in the basket and was charmed out. The doctor's kid across the street had a bunch of little European sports cars, and they had tuned exhaust notes. So, you know, like the interesting little thing that I was, I went marching over to the garage in the next alley and stuck my nose in there, and because I had small hands, I could deal with small parts. So by the time I was 8, 9 years old, I knew how to rebuild a carburetor, and they liked that free labor.
Right. At 22, you learned to fly vintage airplanes?
Oh, I learned to fly, I was in the late teens, early 20s. The vintage aircraft belonged to my instructor, and if I would polish it, he would give me lessons. It was a good trade, I think.
What was the appeal?
He sure had a shiny airplane. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going to get to the speed part. But so is there a connection between the affection you had for airplanes and for racing that came later?
I don't know. I think it's just a question of that anything that moves, I'd like to operate it. I've always maintained that the machine, whether it is driven or flown or steered in the water, it has no idea whether it's a man or a woman behind the wheel. It only responds to input. So this idea that it's something's a man's sport has always been ridiculous to me.
Mm. I read that you were interested in criminal psychology for a few years.
Well, when I was in high school. And then I found cars, and then I found jet cars. And that was...
And you put that
aside.
The
heck with criminal psychology. Yeah. I wanted to go fast.
Right. So at some point, you left Chicago and joined a jet car team?
Oh, yeah. It's like running away to the circus. My mother and father thought I needed psychiatric help myself, frankly. I was managing a recording studio in Chicago, and I through the artwork... I would letter cars and help repair race cars that would blow themselves up at the local tracks at US 30 or Union Grove, Wisconsin. And I would help this painter and letterer. And I just got to know the race car genre and the professional sports that way. And I met a couple of the guys from the jet car world. And, you know, the heck with the pistons. The jets were great. They sounded great. And I was fascinating with those mechanics. And eventually I quit my job with Universal Recording Corporation and took off touring the United States with a J-46 Westinghouse jet dragster and spent a couple of years on the road. For the first year or so, I would fly out after work on Friday from Chicago O'Hare to wherever the race car was, and then I'd catch the red eye first thing Monday morning, get off the airplane at O'Hare and go straight to work because the recording studio was, you know, maybe 20 minutes from the airport. I did that for about a year, and then I finally quit and went racing full time.
So what was it about land speed racing that that caught your attention? It was moving, clearly. It was moving fast.
Yeah, it was a big speed. The quarter mile was okay with the drag racing, but the idea that these guys and gals went a mile, 2 miles, I mean, 5 miles, 7 miles? Holy smokes! I mean, how'd they keep the engines together? And I met Gary Gablich, and I knew Craig Breedlove, and Art Arfons, and Walt Arfons. You know, as you revolve in those circles, you end up meeting these people, and I was always fascinated with the vehicles. So I was going to go out there the 1 year, and a friend of mine who was a automotive journalist in California when I had left Chicago to move to L.A., Tom Center, the late Tom Center, he was the editor over at Popular Hot Rodding Magazine. He asked me if I would drive his car at Bonneville because he couldn't drive and focus on the tune-up. He needed to plug in a driver, he said. So I was going to be his spark plug driver. And that was going to be my first foray onto the salt. Unfortunately, Tom was diagnosed with a fast-moving cancer, and within 4 or 5 months, he was gone, and I never did go out to the salt until after a time in 1997 out at the Black Rock Desert when the Americans and the British were contesting the world record. I had originally been part of Breedlove's team, quit before they went out on the salt, went back to being a journalist, and tried to sell the book idea on Bonneville. Or not on Bonneville, on the supersonic showdown between the British and the Americans. And no one was interested. And a few weeks later, the publisher called back and said, you know, we're not really thinking that would sell anything, but how would you like to write the history of the Bonneville salt flats? Which was just a shocker to me. And that's how I really got heavily involved and immersed up to my hair follicles in the Bonneville salt flats. And I'll tell you, Doug, since doing that, I've given up shooting, writing, or doing any other form of motorsports. I am so enamored and so pleased and so delighted with what goes on out there as far as not just motorsports, but the great American pastime, if you will, as far as I see it. It's really this wonderful family amateur sport that it's ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and that's kind of where we're at today.
Do you remember the first time you saw the Salt Flats?
Oh, indeed I do. I snuck up on them because it came up through Las Vegas. I think it's 93 is that route. And the first time I saw that expanse of salt, I just pulled over to the side of the road and wondered how far it would go. And then I had to go along again and pull over again. After about the sixth time of pulling over, I said, I need to quit this and just get all the way there. And it wasn't until I actually got out on the salt and went down to the far end of the course, and I just stopped and got out, and I was amazed at the quiet. You know, for someone who is deaf or hard of hearing, you're always on tenterhooks trying to hear every little thing because you miss a lot.
Yeah.
But it was the first time in a long time I remembered that the silence was just serene. I just felt wonderful out there.
So I've asked you this before, but I wanted you to explain for those who haven't heard you talk about it. What is it about the salt flats that makes it good for racing? I mean, or certainly unique for racing?
Well, first of all, I thank God as a land speed racer because he made that place. And it is just the biggest expanse. Okay, let's go technically.
Yeah.
A lot of the land speed racers started in Southern California on the dry lake beds with the mud. So after a while of cars running on this, they can break the surface, and it becomes a crumbly, and it's very dangerous. On Bonneville, because it's so hard, or it has been very hard, if you get a flat tire or something breaks, and the tire or the wheel tries to dig in, it's too hard to do that. Like in dirt, it would spin and would turn the car over, and you have an interesting accident usually. On Bonneville, usually if the tire goes flat, the vast majority of cars will probably just spin out, and you tend to embarrass yourself, go back to the pit, and fix your tire and go to race another day. And I'm not to say that people have not died on the flats, but we're at the 64th annual Speed Week. And in 64 years of thousands and thousands of cars, trucks and motorcycles racing out there, I think only 8 people have died. And that's a testament. And remember, these are amateurs. This is not highly financed, sponsored place. So they go out there because it's safe, because it's clean, and you just haven't lived until you've had to clean up your vehicles after being out on the dirt racing, because it's micro fine and it goes stinking everywhere.
I mean, thanks for
and I do that. Mean everywhere.
Yeah. It's interesting you talk about the sort of amateur level appeal of all of this, and you've talked about how that what the amateurs are doing out there, is they're kind of getting more done, I think you've said, than what the people in the professional Formula One racing industry.
My dear, they're the fastest people on Earth, and they could show Formula One how to go fast. The folks that are 400 miles an hour plus, the Birkeland family is a good example. Tom Birkeland lives up in Ogden, Utah, as a matter of fact, and his mom, Betty's out in Great Falls, Montana. Their late dad, Gene, helped build that car. That car's gone 454 miles an hour. He built it in their garage. That's 200 miles an hour faster than anything out there in motorsports, in any other form of motorsports. And it's a family affair. There are generationals. The Vesco family, another Utah family, they're on their third generation. John Vesco started it. His sons, Rick and Don, took it on. And now Ronnie Vesco, Rick's daughter, went 300 miles an hour in the family streamliner. And that's only one of several families. The Volk family, also from Salt Lake, that's a generational thing. Dad and the kids. Oh, and by the way, the two sons and the daughter, the daughter's faster than her brother. It's wonderful. So there's a lot of family stuff. Yeah, your grandmother, grandfather, father, sons and kids can all drive the same car on the same week. And that's happening out there right now. There's a group, Chip Gerber and his dad, Gene. He's 75 years old. Chip and his dad have been trading back and forth driving their car. They're both driving 210, 12 miles an hour, and they have a little contest to see who goes faster each day.
So what do you love about that, that they're not making any money at it, so they're just doing it for the love of it?
That's exactly it. There's a group out there, the Maitreef Sons. They're out of Iowa, and it was dad at 77 years of age, got his boys together, and his oldest son at 54 told me, with tears in his eyes, mind you, that this was really great, that we feel like we're a family again. And they're living their life as though they were 10 and 12 years old and going out to wherever they went out to with Dad. It is a wonderful family opportunity. It's a great place for people to come up with an idea, dream up something, make it safe. You have to go through the technical inspection lines, but then when you earn the right to go to the starting line, you have earned the right to see if you can break a record out there. And if you like, I'll tell folks how that works, because it sometimes they go out there and the cars are zooming all over the place and they really don't know what's going on.
Yeah, do. No, that would be great, actually.
So whatever class you decide to get, whether it's a car, truck, or a motorcycle, and there's a variety of body shapes and a variety of engine sizes and types, you decide what it is, and if you can pass technical inspection, you earn the right to go to the starting line. At that point, you will run either on the short or the long course. It just depends on how fast your car is. Short course, 1 mile, 175 miles and below. Long course are for all vehicles over 175. So let's take the long course, because everybody wants to hear about the fast cars.
Yeah.
Everybody has a 2 mile run-up. You go through the 2 mile, and then there are three timed miles. So from the 2 to the 3, the 3 to the 4, the 4 to the 5. And you shut it off on the 5, and depending on how fast you're going, will determine how much slowdown speed you go. So like I used to tell people, you can get the go, but you got to have the whoa as well. Very important to have whoa.
Right.
So at that point, let's say you're cruising along at 200 miles an hour.
Yeah.
You can pull the parachute and probably turn off by the 6 mile, maybe even the 5.5 sometimes. But if you're going 417 like George Poteet did the other day, you're going to go catch him down at the 7.5 or the 8 mile, because
wow,
he'll throw those parachutes and it's going to take a while to get that energy out of that car. So, all right, the record is, let's take an amorphous deal. The record is 200 miles an hour. You run 210 miles an hour. All of the vehicles that qualify on a record go to a special place in the pits called impound. And during the course of the day, the cars are collected into impound that have qualified on a record. The following morning, first thing in the morning, it's what they call record runs. And you always feel good when you wake up in the morning and you know your race car is in impound because you're going for a record.
So what's...
Let me finish.
Okay, yeah, no, of course.
The
yeah,
cars
sorry.
Come out of impound, they go back to that same starting line,
yep,
and they have to do the run again. Then the two runs, let's say you make the second run at 210 again.
Right.
So that's 210. Your record will be 210 because the average of two runs. I'm not writing it down here. I'm not good with math sometimes. But they add up the two and then divide it by two.
Sure.
And that's your speed. If you've exceeded the record, you go back to inspection, because they got to make sure that if you're in this class with this motor, they inspect to make sure that that's exactly what you have. And once that has been determined, verified, then they will bless you and keep you and tell you you've got a new land speed record.
Right.
And if you've done a very special record where you have broken a record over 200 in the 200 mile an hour club, you could earn life membership and get yourself a red hat, blue hat, or a black hat.
Hmm. So who goes out there, Louise? I get the people who are obsessed with speed and with motors and the typical crowd, but you know, people who maybe wouldn't be necessarily, do they go out there? Should they go out there?
Sure. Here's what I think. It is the great American pastime out there. It's not a place that I would expect everybody to go all the time, but I think every American should go there at least once to see this wonderful event and how it unfolds. It is though you flip a switch and you're back in time. There's not the commercialization. You don't have people sticking things in your face every second to buy something. Go here, do this, you know, but wait, there's more. None of that. You have this opportunity where you can see the great American ingenuity that can do stuff that Kennedy was talking about, you know, what you can do for your country. And you have this wonderful opportunity to walk right up to these cars, right on the starting line, right in the pit. The people will talk to you. I can't tell you how many children and adults have managed to climb into someone else's race car just to sit in it and have that experience. I think of it as the great American, the last vestige of the American Wild West. And the pioneers are these racers who are pioneering new speed marks. Only all the ponies, Doug, they're under the hood.
I want to ask you about the future of the salt flats, because it wasn't so long ago you wrote a piece that where you described the land speed racing community as facing this daunting ecological emergency. Are the salt flats shrinking?
Yeah, they sure are, and it is in a dire shape. When I started, and that's only been about 17-some years ago, when I went out there was pure blistering white all the way to the mountains, as far as you could see. Now, on the edges, you'll see vegetation. Not only has the size of the Bonneville Salt Flats shrunk, but the crust has thinned. So it's now, what looks like this year out there, it looks like a dirty au gratin potato playa that they've managed to smooth out certain spots. But the mining that has gone on for potash for years and years and years, they never really put the waste product back. And the waste product is the salt.
Yeah.
They only want the various minerals. I don't blame the mining people. They have their leases. They're operating under, you know, strict government control. They're doing what they were told. But I blame the BLM directly and squarely. If this were Mount Rushmore or the Grand Canyon or, you know, the Apennine Mountains, there would be a public outrage on the problems that the Bonneville Salt Flats have encountered. And yet, the BLM does not require the mining companies to re-salt or send their waste product, which is the very salt that we need to race on, just back over the freeway. They take it in a brine solution from one side where the speedway is, process it on the other side of Interstate 80, and then take the salt and then just push it around on their side of the freeway instead of putting it back where you got it. You know, my mom said, put it back where you got it, open it if you close it, turn it off if you turn it on. That's all really what needed to happen. But because this has gone on now for decades, just putting back what they took isn't enough. There has to be a restoration where we have to put back more. Otherwise, one of these great natural resources, and forget the racing, Doug, to go out on Bonneville and to see that expanse. I mean, the astronauts use it as a landmark when they're flying around the Earth. To lose that, that's a shame. And I think if the land was under the Parks and Recreation instead of the BLM, maybe we'd have a better steward at the helm looking at the flats, because the Parks and Recreation folks, the land map, they are used to having people recreate. Maybe the Bureau of Land Management isn't used to having people recreate out there, because they're certainly not paying any attention to the racers. And really, the profits are pummeling the pleasure with impunity out there. And you can talk to any of the racers. It's just not my opinion. I think you'll find that this is an opinion held. There's actually a group called Save the Salt and a coalition that's been formed to try and essentially make the BLM do their job.
That's Land Speed Louise Noeth. She's a journalist and automotive historian, author of Bonneville Salt Flats, The Fastest Place on Earth. We should mention she's giving a lecture about racing on the Bonneville Salt Flats on Sunday, August 19th at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. The lecture begins at 1. It's part of an ongoing exhibit there. Features 19 of the sleekest and fastest race cars in the world. You can visit our website for the details about that, KUER.org/Radio West. Louise, thanks.
Hey, Doug. My pleasure.
When we get back from a break, we're going to be joined by representatives from the direct sales and multi-level marketing industry. We're giving them a chance to respond to our conversation on Tuesday that raised questions about their business practices. So we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On Tuesday, we had a program that talked about the business practices of the multi-level marketing industry. There have been a few articles about the industry that have appeared in the last few months. We had two of the journalists who have been writing about it on the program. The reporter Stephanie Mensimer explored the connection between multi-level marketing and Mormonism. In the August issue of Harper's, there's a piece about Mary Kay Cosmetics by the reporter Virginia Soul Smith. Today on the program, we're giving representatives from the industry an opportunity to respond to that. We didn't include them in the program, and We're trying to correct that today. Joining us on the program is Laura Beitler. She's Vice President of Compliance with Mary Kay Cosmetics. She's joining us today from a studio in Dallas, Texas. And Laura Beitler, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Joseph Mariano is also with us, president of the Direct Selling Association. It's a trade association based in Washington, D.C. The DSA represents nearly 200 direct selling companies. They include Mary Kay Cosmetics and several regional companies like New Skin, USANA, Sensi. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington. And Joseph Mariano, welcome to you.
Hi, Doug. It's great to have the opportunity. We appreciate it.
So I wanted to start... I wanted to stipulate a few things so we can kind of move the conversation forward, because I want you to be able to address some of the specific allegations that came up on Tuesday. I want to see if we can stipulate that this is that the business practices, that this is legal, though I'm sure there might be some exceptions and there might be some debate. But for our purposes today, let's say this is a legal enterprise and that people who get involved do it for various reasons. Not everyone is out there to make $1 million. You know, they do it for, you know, different kinds of things. Let's also stipulate that there's no guarantee for success and that it's like any business. You know, some win, some lose. And let's also agree that this is not for everyone. It's a challenging job. It seems like those are some basic things that I guess we can agree on, because there are some specific things I want to get you to respond to. And I'm wondering, is that okay with you?
Sure. This is Joe. I'll definitely accept the stipulation. I mean, we've been around as a trade association for 100 years representing direct selling companies, and some of the multi-level forms of direct selling that we'll be discussing have existed for decades, literally 50 years. So I think your stipulations are fair.
Good. Okay. So it seems like the central allegation from critics is that the model is designed not to make money off of the product, but to make money off people who get other people to sell the product down the line. Who wants to start with that? Respond to that, if you would.
Let me take the first shot.
Okay, go ahead, John.
If I can, Laura, thank you. As the representative for the entire industry, not just Mary Kay, but as you said, about 200 other companies, and we represent about 95% of total direct sales in the United States, our companies do. So I think we can speak with a position of authority and credibility on this. Sure. In a direct selling company, we market our products through personal explanation and demonstration. That's done by the individual sellers, but it's also done by the recruits of the sellers. Unlike traditional retailers or standard retailers, we're not buying shelf space at the local market. Instead, we get a network of people out there to sell our products. It allows us to reduce costs and use the money that might otherwise be spent to buy that shelf space or advertising to compensate people in our sales organizations. It's actually a great model.
So the idea that that the product doesn't really, I mean, that is the criticism you hear, that the product doesn't really matter. It's getting people to sell whatever. You're disputing that, of course.
Well, of course. I mean, obviously, if you're going to sell something, you have to be able to sell it. And selling it to the ultimate consumer, somebody who wants to use that product because they like it, because they value it, is the key. You can't sell something just for the sake of selling it. It's despite the name of the organization, the Direct Selling Association, we're in the business of selling product to people who use the product. And that's the terrific thing. Our surveys indicate that the people who get involved, as well as the people who buy from the people who get involved, are extraordinarily satisfied with their experience, both as sellers and then as consumers of those products, whether they be cosmetics or nutritional supplements or long-distance telephone service or anything that is sold. The fallacy is that the focus is on recruiting. The fact of the matter is, yes, we recruit. It's important to get people to sell our product, as in any business. But ultimately, the success of all our businesses is determined by the quality and value of the products that we're putting out in the marketplace. If we didn't have quality products, nobody would buy them, and recruiting would be pointless.
Laura, it's also said of the industry that the model is built around, you know, reaching out to neighbors and family members, members of your church group, for example. How do you respond to that claim that this kind of tactic, you know, has the potential of, you know, exploiting relationships, exerting undue influence over people? How do you react to that?
Well, I think you have to think about just a practical analogy. So let's say tomorrow you decide to start a hardware store down the street. Well, of course, you're going to reach out to your friends and your family and let them know. But you're also going to work really hard to make sure that you get out in the community and that you share information about your business. You might start a website. Mm-hmm. And Mary Kay Independent Beauty Consultants are in the exact same situation. Mary Kay offers them an opportunity to have a beautifully branded website where they can have an internet presence to then go out in the community and share information about their business. It's up to them to absolutely build their customer base, and they do just like any other small business does to build their customers.
Here's another contention that we've heard, that really the people who mostly buy the product aren't, in fact, general consumers, but the sales associates themselves who've been convinced to be a part of the program.
Let me
Joseph
take a
Mariano,
shot at
take that.
That.
Yeah,
thanks. First, that's probably true in the sense that all of our sellers use the products. One of the reasons they get involved in the business is because they were at a home party or they had a friend who sold them the product and they said, "This is great. Yeah. I love this product. Can I get involved in selling it and make a little extra money too?" And that resulted in last year in 2011 about 16 million or so people getting involved. So sure, they're customers as well as sellers, and we want them to be. And that's important. These folks can be sellers as well as customers of the product. Now, there are many, many customers beyond those sellers themselves. It's just the nature of a $30 billion industry. We sell $30 billion in estimated retail sales of product to ultimate consumers of one type or another. To get back to your earlier question, too, about selling to people they know,
yeah.
Well, of course, Laura's absolutely correct. And, you know, one of the concerns I had about the guests you had on earlier in the week was that they were reporting based upon their own personal perspective and some anecdote, as I read it. The evidence that we cite and the statistics that we cite are based upon real research and talking to thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people across the country over the year about this. And of our statistics, our fact-based analysis, 96% of our sellers say that they approach people they know, at least at first. Mm. 91% of the people say they approach people they know indirectly. But importantly, 61% also say they approach people they don't already know. So, of course, they're selling to their friends, their neighbors, their relatives, themselves, as well as other people who hopefully will like and enjoy the product.
You know, you've pointed out—
That's fact-based.
Yeah. You've pointed out before that that sales associates are not required to buy the products, that it's their choice about how much they want to buy, that there are these buyback protections. Mm-hmm. But we've heard that the tactics used to get them to buy inventory involves coercion, high-pressure techniques, those kinds of things. That was a contention that came up. Who wants to take that as a response? Laura Beitler?
Yeah, I'd be happy to take that. The answer is it's that is a broad, sweeping, limited view. The fact is that every beauty consultant has a choice as to whether or not she has products on hand to sell to her customers. And Mary Kay works extremely hard to make sure that they have options. So, for example, we offer a customer delivery service, which allows consultants, if they wish, to have products drop shipped directly from the company to their customers. So she never has to have a product on her shelf if she chooses not to. Each person has to make a choice based upon their personal circumstances, what their personal goals are. And I don't think we can emphasize enough something that you briefly mentioned, which is the 90% buyback. This is something that has been part of Mary Kay's business model since the very beginning, since 1963. And it was very important to Mary Kay because she wanted women to have the opportunity to be just as happy if they made a decision to end their business as they were the day they started their business. And as Joe can attest, it was not only so important to her for our business, but she worked with others, including the DSA, to have this championed as a requirement across the globe for our industry. And I don't know many small businesses that offer you the opportunity after a year to buy back any inventory that you purchased for 90%. It's a significant protection that we have for people.
But you hear the response from Virginia Soul Smith about that, that there is, you know, pressure down the line not, in fact, to return the inventory, that you're letting your sisters down, depriving other people of income. So there is, so it's not as quite as easy as that because you feel this kind of pressure not to let the people down the line down.
Well,
let me talk about that,
yeah,
if I can, Laura, just a little bit. Because I find that actually that assertion by Ms. Soleil Smith a little bit condescending. I mean, first of all, these are intelligent, sophisticated people, both men and women, who are getting involved in a small micro-entrepreneurial experience. And to suggest that if their own economic interests are threatened, that they wouldn't take advantage of every protection and guarantee that they should, is kind of ludicrous. But nonetheless, I mean, if there was a problem, if there ever was a problem in the legitimate direct selling industry with coercive sales techniques and pressuring people to buy, we wanted to respond to that, and we have responded to it, as Laura suggested, 20 years ago. In fact, let's talk about this in terms of consumer protection. Real pyramid schemes out there, that is fraudulent, illegal operations, the ones you stipulated at the beginning of the conversation are not direct sellers, are folks who like to pretend they're like us. And one of the things they do, in fact, is load people up with inventory. They, in fact, compensate people only for recruiting rather than product sales. And we've known as an industry that we've had an obligation and a responsibility to make sure that the public understands the difference. One of the differences is that we don't allow inventory loading. We don't allow people to end up with garage fulls of inventory. How do we prevent that? With this inventory buyback policy. In 1992, we adopted it, and we said our companies are going to adopt this, so there's absolutely no question. And coercion aside, or willingness to take advantage of it aside, we insist that our companies publicize that requirement, that buyback requirement, if you will. And by goodness, if they don't adhere to it, they'll be kicked out of the association or otherwise disciplined. Not to mention that there are several state laws that also mandate that, which, by the way, we've supported and in some cases asked to be adopted. So, you know, we're absolutely committed to the buyback, and we have enough respect for the people who get involved in direct selling that they're going to act in their own self-interest. And if they want to leave, they'll certainly take advantage of that. And they do.
Do you know
and
whether—
the 2 points that I'm sorry, the no, two no, go points ahead. That I'd just love to add, Doug, is number one, just as an example of what a real life example of what Joe just shared, Mary Kay publishes its buyback in the beauty consultant agreement that every consultant signs. It's published in the starter kit that every beauty consultant receives when she starts her business, and it's shared throughout our company materials as well, so they are absolutely well informed. And then the second point I'd like to make is the reality is pressure doesn't work over the long term. This company, Mary Kay, has been in business for 50 years. We would not be in business and have the track record that we had if there was that kind of activity going on consistently. And on the rare occasion when it happens, as Joe notes, it is addressed swiftly and appropriately.
Do you know whether or not, this question came up, whether more people succeed or fail in these enterprises? Do you know the response to that?
Well, let me give you the industry statistics, at least as best that I have them. We estimate that there is a large turnover rate. That is, meaning people come into the business and leave the business quite frequently. Yeah. Now, the reason for that, I guess we could quibble or debate whether we want to qualify it as success or failure. The fact of the matter is most people don't earn huge amounts of money. And to the extent that our model has been criticized by others because that's not said, I'm saying it here. Most people involved in direct selling don't earn a lot of money. In fact, they, however, achieve their goals, and their goals are multifaceted. That can be to earn just a little bit of money. Most of the people who get involved in these businesses are working just a few hours a week, maybe only a few weeks out of the year. So the fact that they earn less than a few hundred dollars, $500 over the course of the year is not a failure. In fact, it's a great success for many of them. Now, for those who work significant hours, who put in 35 hours or more a week, and do this on a full-time basis, our statistics suggest that a significant percentage of them are actually doing quite well. In fact, some of the statistics suggest that the average earnings for those folks is over $50,000, and at least 10% of them are earning over $100,000 a year from these direct selling businesses. But I don't want to get into the game, frankly, of saying, well, people aren't earning $1 million. Of course, our businesses encourage folks to get involved and suggest to them that if they spend a lot of time, energy, and skill, they're, unlike many other businesses, they'll be able to earn a lot of money. But that's not why most people get involved, at least not at first. And so they succeed according to their own standards of success.
So the question came up as to whether or not multi-level marketers are being honest with potential sales associates. You know, you hear this accusation that they're sharing all of these grand success stories, but they don't convey a typical experience to a potential sales associate. And you know what a typical sales associate could actually or will actually. I mean, you know, you see those disclaimers on commercials for weight loss programs, and you see that the average customer loses, you know, X amount of weight, and that doesn't necessarily reflect a typical response. You know, these kinds of disclaimers.
Right.
And what you're hearing from people like Virginia Sol Smith and Stephanie Mensimer is that you're not doing that. You're not telling people what they're in for when they get into these enterprises.
Well, actually, I think the claim is a little bit different. I think the claim from people like Virginia and others is that, well, yes, we see that there are disclosures and we see that there are buybacks and there are other policies. But you know what? People just don't really – they're not smart enough or they're not bright enough to really take advantage of those or respond to them. The fact of the matter is, as Laura will tell you, our companies are very clear. Yes, we talk about the aspirations of people and what hopefully you can achieve and will be given the opportunity to achieve. But we are also very realistic, as I just was, in terms of what people will actually earn if they do this on a part-time and limited basis.
And I can share a specific example from Mary Kay in the fact that we have an entire department that is our sales education department, and it is their job to teach consultants how to conduct this business, both in product sales and if they choose to share information about a Mary Kay business. In addition to that, we have a sales development department that works to guide them along the way in meeting their goals in their business, whatever they may be. And then finally, as a 360 view of it all, there's my group, which is responsible for addressing any anomaly that ever happens so that we can ensure we keep a clear and consistent message out there to our sales force that there must be the truthful and accurate representation of our opportunity.
And Doug, if I can add one point, just to be clear, we don't stick our heads in the sand. Look, one of my colleagues says that with 16 million people out there who sell for our companies at any particular time or over the course of a year, we're larger than many nations. And with 16 million people, especially as independent business people, some of them are not going to always do the right thing or say the right thing. It may be a small percentage, but it's an important percentage. So we have to take those situations where somebody overpromises or misrepresents very seriously, and we do. And that's why people like Laura and her department exist. And those are analogous. They exist in virtually every one of our companies, and why the association itself was in fact created to make sure that our companies and the independent business people are exercising the highest level of business ethics and responsiveness to consumers. And we take that commitment absolutely seriously, which is why the kinds of criticisms that we heard on the program earlier this week, which are really based on anecdote and a particular perspective from a very limited number of people, was of concern. You know, having a computer keyboard in front of you and being able to say something doesn't make you an expert on the subject. And I'm afraid that that's what we're seeing.
Joseph Mariano is with us, president of the Direct Selling Association in Washington, D.C. Laura Beitler, also with us, vice president of compliance with Mary Kay Cosmetics, located there in Dallas, Texas. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've invited two representatives from the direct selling industry to join us to respond to our program on Tuesday. Laura Beitler is with us, vice president of compliance with Mary Kay Cosmetics, and Joseph Mariano was with us, president of the Direct Selling Association in Washington. So I wanted to ask you the big question that came up on Tuesday and seems to come up in this conversation is why you don't track retail sales. Laura Beitler, why not?
Well, they're independent business owners. Again, my example earlier about Joe's hardware store down the street, Black & Decker is not going to ask him for a list of the customers that he sold his products to. So at Mary Kay, we respect the privacy of that information. But what I can tell you is because we offer them personal websites, we have aggregate data that shows that just through our personal website program alone that we offer to beauty consultants, tens of millions of dollars worth of product was ordered by end consumers from their beauty consultants last year alone. In addition, we have the customer delivery service that I mentioned earlier where consultants can drop ship product from the company directly to their customers. And millions of dollars just last month alone were shipped out through that program. That is just a fraction of the sales that occur between our beauty consultants and their end consumers. We've got incredible products with incredible science behind them. We spend millions of dollars a year to create tools and education for our consultants to sell their products. And clearly there is an end consumer demand for these products.
But the contention is that you don't track retail sales for sure, but you can. And the reason you don't is because that would keep you from revealing the average earning income of your sales associates. That's
absolutely incorrect. The reason that we don't is because they are independent business owners.
Now, the models that we use in direct selling, Doug, are multiple, actually. They all have in common, these companies and the individuals that sell for them, this personal explanation and demonstration. But in many instances, a company will sell product to this independent seller who then turns around and sells it. Frankly, they can sell it in any way they choose or at any price they choose. And increasingly, we see those sales taking place in the office and in the home on a door-to-door basis and home parties through social media. And so ultimately, it is their business. There are other companies.
Yeah, but why can't they just report it back? Why can't they report it back to Nu Skin and report it back to Mary Kay? I don't understand
that.
Sometimes
they do. Some companies have that information. Others don't have it in as much detail. But in fact, it's a little bit of a red herring. As I talked about before, some of those sales to the sellers are in fact retail sales and that those individual sellers are using the products themselves. Some of them are not. And it gets, look, these are not sophisticated business people. These are part-time sellers. And, you know, sometimes they're selling it to other people. Sometimes they're selling it or using it themselves. So I don't think we should get distracted into saying how many retail customers do you have. They're all customers. The fact of the matter is, and let's look at this from a consumer protection
major,
point
but
of
view.
Let me get this point out because it's important, Doug. Because one of the things I think that is good about the debate is that companies or people who are listening need to understand the distinction between a pyramid scheme and a legitimate company.
Right.
In a pyramid scheme, people are being compensated only for recruitment. In a legitimate company, people are being compensated for sales of product that are really being used, whether those sales are to people outside the organization or other sellers inside the organization. That's the key distinction legally, practically, morally, and in every sense. It doesn't matter really whether or not my sister, who signed up as a distributor and salesperson for one of our companies, is purchasing and using the product herself or she's purchasing and reselling to other people. They're all legitimate sales, and that's why this argument is a little bit of a distraction, I think, and a disservice to consumers.
But but wouldn't tracking that information help you sort of cover this question? It's being able to say we're able to say that this many people buy inventory and this is the general public buying product.
Well, actually, that's an interesting suggestion. And I think one of the things that we're looking at as an industry now is whether or not we should begin to report that in the aggregate as an industry more definitively than we have, not because there's an absolute need to do it, but just so that if the question comes up and it becomes a distraction, we can say, well, all right, well, here's the number, but it doesn't mean a lot because it is a distraction.
Right,
so
right.
Maybe that is an approach that we should take in the future. But frankly, when we talk about it to the public, I think we run the risk of really confusing the issue for people. Look, the reality is right now, there are real pyramid schemes out there that are taking advantage of people. And if we focus on the wrong questions, like how many retail customers Mary Kay can report corporately, well, that's the wrong issue. We need to focus on whether the plan is merely recruiting people and compensating on the basis of the investment they make for recruitment rather than on generating real product sales to any number of people.
Well, and I can say, I think for Mary Kay, our continued longevity, reputation, and success, the facts speak for itself on that point as well.
And let me also, I know we just have a few more minutes, but I wanted to make sure that we addressed a couple of other issues for you just quickly that were of concern. The assertions that were made, they're just patently false in the reports earlier. First, that direct selling somehow isn't regulated or is regulated in a different manner than any other retail business. Just not true. Our products, the nutritionals and all the other products, the claims that are made by our companies or the salespeople are subject to the same standards federally and state by state as every other business. The fact that they're sold person to person is not a reason for no regulation.
But you also heard the contention that the FTC is not scrutinizing the industry like it used to, because the industry has gotten involved in efforts to try to, you know, tamp down disclosure, those kinds of things. Respond to that.
Well, absolutely. We have a very constructive relationship with law enforcement across the country. One of the things that I'm charged with doing is talking to representatives of the FTC and attorneys general offices to find out what their problems are with the industry and then make sure our self-regulatory mechanisms and our legislative approaches are consistent with the public interest. So we have heard, in fact, of many issues that the FTC and the state AGs have with the industry and with business in general, and we try to respond to those. And yes, it's absolutely true that we prefer self-regulation of the industry to government interference, because government cannot understand nor regulate every aspect of every business effectively. That's why our code exists, and why when there are problems, we would prefer consumers or aggrieved distributors to come to our independent code administrator under our standards. But if that's not sufficient, there are legal standards that apply, and believe me, there are plenty of complaints that go to the Federal Trade Commission and analogous state organizations that relate to direct selling companies and business in general.
But I want to jump in because I want to ask one more question.
Sure.
We've got a minute left. What we've heard is that while there may be those programs that there are those who break the law, as you mentioned before, but I guess what we're talking about is the question isn't whether the model that you have is legal, but whether it's ethically questionable, that, you know, whether you're exploiting vulnerable people. I mean, you hear the same contention about, you know, casinos and payday loan operations. Somebody take that on. We got about a minute left, finally.
I'll do a quick one and then let Laura close. 80% of the people that we've surveyed involved in direct selling say their expectations were met or exceeded. 85% describe their experiences in our companies as excellent, good, or very good. 86% said they're very likely to continue as a rep. Now, beyond the statistics, I just got back from one of our meetings of our companies. I do this all the time, that they have with many people. There were about 500 women there, for the most part, who sold these products. And they represented all of these reasons and motivations for getting involved. They weren't stupid. They were smart. They were enjoying themselves. Some of them were making money. I dare anyone to go and talk to those people face to face and say that they weren't ethical or that they weren't enjoying their experience.
Laura, I'm just going to – you may have to just say amen to that, whereas we're out of time.
amen to
okay.
that.
Okay. Joseph Mariano, president of the Direct Selling Association. Laura Beitler, vice president of compliance for Mary Kay. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.